Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 4th of July, these are our main stories. As hundreds of Israeli troops continue a major raid in the occupied West Bank, the Prime Minister says the operation will continue until security is restored. A fundraising campaign for the French policeman who shot dead a teenager, sparking nearly a week of riots, has raised more than $1 million. An audio message, apparently by the leader of a mutiny in Russia, Yevgeny Prigozhin, promises more victories on the front line. Also in this podcast,
je pense que ça, conserver la paix.
I think the first thing is to preserve peace. Do what it takes to keep the peace. Because war is a misery. It ends with widows and orphans.
The last surviving French commando from the D-Day landings has died at the age of 100. As we record this podcast, hundreds of Israeli soldiers, backed by drone aircraft and armoured bulldozers, are continuing a sustained assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the outskirts of the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, 24 hours after it began. In recent months, tensions between Israel and the Palestinians have been particularly high, and the camp has become the frequent target of Israeli raids. On Monday, the densely populated area where Israel says militant attacks have been planned was once again the focus of attention. Israel says it's a counter-terrorism operation. Palestinian leaders have accused the Israelis of carrying out an invasion. At least 8 Palestinians have been killed and dozens more wounded. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, says that the military operation will continue for as long as it's needed to restore calm and security.
In recent months, Jenin has become a haven for terrorism. We are putting an end to that. Our forces entered Jenin into the terrorists' nests. They are eliminating terrorists. They are arresting wanted persons. They are destroying headquarters and seizing many weapons. They are destroying laboratories that are at an almost industrial scale. Labs from which explosives were dispatched, devices designed to kill and murder Israeli civilians.
The BBC's Middle East correspondent, Yoland Nell, watched the day's events unfold in the city of Jenin, a short distance from the refugee camp itself.
By dawn, the battles had been raging for hours in Jenin. The Israeli military used a surprise drone strike overnight to target what it said was the headquarters of local militants. Soon, armed Palestinians were fighting back. Hundreds of Israeli soldiers are on the ground. The Israeli military says they're seizing weapons and explosives, and that this is a hornet's nest for terrorism. There was a furious response from Palestinian officials. What's going on is an attempt to erase the refugee camp completely and displace the residents, said the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shtayyeh. Palestinian medics have been struggling to reach the dozens of injured. Israel says it's acting on precise intelligence and doesn't seek to harm civilians, but many have been caught in the crossfire.
What's going on in the refugee camp is real war. There were strikes from the sky targeting it. Every time we drive in with our ambulances, we come back full with injured people.
You get those cracks of gunshots coming from the Jenin refugee camp, which is just up there on the hill. Sometimes we get loud explosions as well. Even though the Israeli military has said this is a closed zone, we're not allowed as journalists to get any closer. You can really get a sense from here of just how intense the fighting is. In recent months, many Palestinians who've carried out deadly attacks on Israelis have come from this area. Others have hid here. And even before today, Jenin's seen repeated deadly Israeli army raids. Israel says it doesn't want to expand this military operation to other parts of the West Bank. But already, Palestinian protests have reached the Gaza Strip. And the longer this action goes on in Jenin, the greater the risk of a dangerous, wider escalation.
Yolande Nell. Well, our world affairs correspondent, Paul Adams, considers a long-term goal of the Israeli operation.
It is clear that the pressure for this operation came from precisely those hard right elements within a very right-wing government. They have seen these attacks on Jewish settlers living in parts of the West Bank, and they are demanding action. There is some suggestion in the Israeli press that not everyone in the military is entirely happy about this because they see the very real prospect of this leading to a wider escalation. I think the thing to remember here is, who are these gunmen that they're going after? We're talking about men in their late teens, in their 20s. They have a complete disdain for their own political leadership, the Palestinian Authority. They have grown up knowing no peace process. You know, 20, 25 years that they've been alive, there has not been a peace process worth the name. And so they don't see any prospect of a dialogue or of a resolution of their existential problems through anything other than the gun. Their mission is to confront the occupation. And confronting the occupation for them means the Israeli army and the Jewish settlers who are living in those Jewish communities around the West Bank. There are always going to be fresh groups of young men coming up behind them, willing to fight that same fight in the complete absence of any kind of political prospect.
Paul Adams. More than $1 million has been raised to support the French policeman charged with shooting dead a teenager last week. The killing of 17-year-old Nael had triggered days of rioting across France, but a similar campaign to raise money for the victim's family has received less than $250,000. Here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
Just in case France didn't feel quite divided enough, the recent riots have prompted two rival fundraising campaigns. It's a right-wing commentator, Jean Messia, who's been seeking donations for the police officer, 40,000 people heeded that call, and the leader of the Conservative Republicans Party has said he too might contribute. But all this has infuriated MPs on the political left and centre. One from the governing Renaissance Party called the donations indecent and scandalous. Far less money has been raised for the family of Nael Merzouk, who was shot dead. His grandmother said that left her heartbroken.
Paul Moss. An audio message purporting to be from the man who led the mutiny in Russia last month has appeared on social media.
Я хочу, чтобы вы понимали, наш марш справедливости.
In the brief recording, what appears to be the voice of the Wagner leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, says that his so-called March for Justice achieved its aims of fighting traitors and mobilising society, and that there will be more victories on the front line. If confirmed, this audio would be the first sign of life from the Wagner leader in a week. One of his key demands had been the removal of the Russian Defence Minister, Sergei Shoigu. But he remains in place and has now made his first public comments since the mutiny, insisting it had not affected frontline troops in Ukraine.
I want to touch upon another issue. Our Supreme Commander has already given comprehensive commentary on it. It's about the attempt to destabilise the situation in Russia on June the 23rd and 25th. These plans failed primarily because the personnel of the armed forces were faithful to their oath and their military duty. The provocation did not affect the actions of army groups. The troops courageously and selflessly continued carrying out the tasks entrusted to them.
To try to get a better understanding of what lies behind Mr. Prigozhin's message, I spoke to Vitaly Shevchenko, who's a Russia editor of BBC Monitoring.
It sounds like him. The emotion is definitely there, and it appears to have been recorded no earlier than the 1st of July, because in that audio clip, Yevgeny Prigozhin mentions a car rally that was held in support of his Wagner group in Novosibirsk, in Siberia, last Saturday. He doesn't say anything about where he is. In fact, mystifyingly, we've not heard anything from Prigozhin about Belarus at all. It's officials in the Kremlin, including President Putin and the Belarusian leader Lukashenko, who are saying that he's supposed to move to Belarus, but Yevgeny Prigozhin didn't say anything about that himself. So in his audio message, Yevgeny Prigozhin thanks the people of Novosibirsk for their support and also tells them that they would see more of our victories on the front line soon. It's unclear whose hour, presumably Wagner, but also it's not clear which front line he means. Could it be Ukraine, because this is where Wagner's been active? Could it be northern Ukraine, because this is where Wagner can threaten from Belarus? Again, that's unclear.
So a very short statement compared to previous statements he's made. And he's talking about that short-lived mutiny, saying that he succeeded in much of what he was setting out to achieve. And yet the defence minister that he wanted to see replaced is still in post.
Yes, Sergei Shoigu appeared today at a meeting of the defence ministry in Moscow. And he mentioned the apparent failed mutiny as well. He thanked the Russian armed forces for, and I quote, staying loyal to their oath. But most of what Sergei Shoigu said, as usual, has been focused on claimed success achieved by Russia on the front line in Ukraine. He said about 1,000 pieces of Ukraine armed hardware has been destroyed. So the big mystery now is where exactly Yevgeny Prigozhin is and what his plans are.
Vitaly Shevchenko. The award-winning Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina has died from her injuries after a Russian missile strike on a busy pizza restaurant in the eastern city of Kramatorsk. She was 37. She was with a group of Colombian journalists and writers when the restaurant was hit. Sergio Jaramillo Caro, a Colombian politician, was in the restaurant with her during the missile strike. He spoke to the BBC.
As we sat down and the food was brought to us and we were just about to start eating, then suddenly this kind of very, very dry, thumping noise near the hole. We were under a glass roof that just was blown away. Then you see all these kind of particles moving in slow motion before your eyes, and you try and understand what's going on, and that's what happened. That's what it feels like.
In November, Victoria Amelina spoke to the BBC about the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine.
I was finishing my novel about this war, but about its hybrid phase that started in 2014. Mm-hmm. This novel had to be about this dilemma of which photographers often face. Like, what do you want to do? Do you want to take a picture or do you want to intervene and change the situation?
The journalist Christina Lam knew Victoria Amelina. My colleague Razia Iqbal asked her for her reaction to the Ukrainian writer's death.
It's heartbreaking. I mean, you know, here was this young woman, so full of life, so full of talent, a poet, a writer, a mother, who had decided to put her life on hold in a way to document war crimes during the war. And she was having a pizza. You know, she wasn't in a trench. She wasn't in some military installation. And this happened. And I had just seen her a few weeks ago when I was in Kyiv. I went to her flat for dinner. And ironically, I was saying to her, because at that time, Kyiv was being under a sort of blizzard of missiles every night, and she lived in a very high apartment. And so I was saying to her, do you feel safe here? And she said, yeah, no problem, you know. And she was very excited because she was due to go off to Paris to work on a writing fellowship. She was going to be with her son, her 11-year-old son, who she hadn't been with for a long time. And so this, you know, was really probably the last trip she was doing before that.
Tell us about the work that she was doing, the collecting of data, the Crimes Against Humanity project that she was working on.
She was part of this group called Truth Hounds, and she was going to things like libraries and schools and documenting a lot about what happened to writers. And actually she sort of came to prominence in a way because she, one of the first people or places she went to was the home of a well-known children's writer, Vladimir Vakulenko, and he had been killed by the Russians in where he lived near Kharkiv. And she spoke to his father, who said that Vladimir had actually been keeping a diary of the Russian occupation and had buried it under a tree in the garden. So she found it and rescued that and brought it to people's attention. So she was very active in sort of documenting what was happening to writers.
I wonder, when you talk about her not being in a trench and she was just sitting in a restaurant eating a pizza, it tells us so much about the nature of war, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really brings home, you know, the brutality of this. I mean, that isn't a military installation. And here was a young woman that was, you know, she was collecting stories about what was happening to her country. She was introducing people she was with, as you had in that report earlier, the Colombian politician, writer. She was trying to bring people from outside into Ukraine, writers from Ukraine outside. She spoke at the London Book Festival in April this year to talk to people about what was happening. She was a real advocate for writers, apart from, you know, her own writing.
That was a journalist, Christina Lam, talking about the Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina, who was one of 13 people killed in a Russian strike on a restaurant. New research using smartwatches has discovered it may be possible to diagnose Parkinson's disease up to 7 years before key symptoms appear. Scientists in the Welsh capital Cardiff say that tracking a combination of factors, including inactivity during the day and poor sleep at night, produces early warning signs. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports.
Parkinson's is a disease that affects brain cells, causing stiffness of limbs and tremors. Often by the time a patient has a diagnosis, more than half of these cells have died. Researchers at the Dementia Research Institute used UK Biobank data from around 100,000 people. They'd been given smartwatches to wear for a week between 2013 and 2016. The watches measured their average acceleration, speed of movement and sleep. Then in 2021, scientists examined those movements, in particular looking at those who went on to have a diagnosis of Parkinson's up to 7 years later. The study's leader, Dr. Cynthia Sandor, said compared with the healthy control group, there was a marked difference in the type of movement of people who were in the early stages.
We find that people are napping during the day. They can sleep more than the normal population, and they can wake up, they can move more during the night. We find some movement activity during the night.
The scientists said that artificial intelligence, or AI, was able to use the smartwatch data to identify who would develop Parkinson's in the future, and they said it was more accurate than any other method. How useful is this finding? There is no cure for Parkinson's and few treatments, but in the future it's thought that catching the disease early could be important in preventing damage to the brain.
Sophie Hutchinson. Still to come.
Tomatoes in Lovage stock and Basil emulsion, crabs from Friesland with dumplings, and Prince Pückler ice cream.
What do you do with a lavish state banquet if your VIP guest cancels at short notice?
Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast from the BBC World Service ranking the best African players.
This guy is recognised as the best in the world.
Teams.
Ball coming, turn, boom.
And the biggest moments in African football.
The whole world remembers that.
Remember that, yeah.
It's not just African fans.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Police in Hong Kong have offered rewards of nearly $130,000 for the capture of 8 exiled pro-democracy activists, some of whom live in the UK. They're wanted under China's sweeping national security law that was imposed on Hong Kong in 2020 in the wake of widespread anti-government protests. One activist has told the BBC the price on his head has put him in danger. James Landell reports.
Since Hong Kong imposed draconian national security laws 3 years ago, hundreds of pro-democracy campaigners have been arrested and convicted. But others fled and are now being targeted in exile. The Hong Kong police have issued arrest warrants for 8 such activists, accusing them of a range of offences punishable by life in jail. And for the first time, they've promised financial rewards for information leading to their arrest.
Lee
Kwai-wah, a police spokesman, accused the eight of crimes endangering Hong Kong's national security, including collusion with foreign entities. And he claimed the laws applied outside of Hong Kong. Those being sought include trade unionists, former legislators and legal scholars, all living in the UK, the US and Australia. These countries don't have extradition treaties with China, but one of the accused, Nathan Law, told me the bounty would make his life more dangerous.
There could possibly be someone in the UK or in anywhere else to provide information of me to them. For example, on my whereabouts, whether they could possibly extradite me when I'm transiting in certain countries. So all these things may put my life into dangerous situations if I'm not careful enough of who I meet or where I go.
The human rights group Hong Kong Watch condemned the arrest warrants and urged the UK, US and Australian governments to issue statements guaranteeing the safety of the named activists.
James Landell. Well, another of those eight exiled activists is Anna Kwok, who took part in the 2019 protests and is now the executive director of the Hong Kong Democracy Council, a non-profit organisation for the pro-democracy movement. Razia Iqbal spoke to her.
I woke up this morning to see there's a $1 million Hong Kong dollar bounty on my head. And the first thing I did was to laugh at it because it's absurd for the government to think that they have the extraterritorial power to actually arrest anyone outside of Hong Kong. And it's obvious that they're trying to use this intimidation tactic to really ask activists to not speak about our issues anymore. But what they don't know is the kind of action they're doing is actually encouraging us to go further and to know that what we have been doing is correct and on track. For example, our demand to the Biden administration to not let John Lee, the sanctioned Hong Kong's chief executive, to enter the US in November.
So from everything you're saying, you are not in any way deterred, nor do you sound particularly afraid.
I am not deterred at all. And if anything, I feel more encouraged and motivated to do our work at the Hong Kong Democracy Council.
What is it that you think that the Hong Kong police are going to be able to do by issuing this bounty?
The first thing is definitely I can see them using this to contact the other countries and the Interpol system who may help them to extradite some of us. So I do see this as an action to try to test who their allies are and who would be helpful in arresting Hong Kongers who have, as they say, betrayed the Hong Kong government.
Have you been in touch with the other seven on the list?
Yes, I have been. And I can say that none of us feel scared about the bounty or, you know, the wanted posters.
We are acutely aware of the surveillance capacity of the Chinese authorities. How concerned are you that you are already being watched or have been for some time?
I do believe that I have been watched for some time, especially because I'm the executive director of the Hong Kong Democracy Council, a sanctioned organization by the Chinese government. Even if we are outside of Hong Kong, it's a reality that the Chinese Communist Party is using every single way possible to monitor our lives, monitor our actions, just so they can know what's going on and just so they can control their people, even when people are outside.
Anna Kwok. The trial of the American actor Kevin Spacey, who's accused of sexual assault, has heard an alleged victim describe him as a predator and a slippery, difficult person. The man worked with Spacey in the early 2000s when the Hollywood star was artistic director for one of London's most famous theatres. The 63-year-old, who won two Oscars for his roles in American Beauty and The Usual Suspects, denies all the charges against him. Helena Wilkinson reports from Southwark Crown Court in London.
On the second day of the trial, the Hollywood actor was back in the glass dock in courtroom one. Jurors were played a recording of one of the accuser's police interviews. The man alleged that Kevin Spacey assaulted him up to 12 times any time they became alone, he said. In one incident, he alleged that the actor groped him so forcefully while driving that he was forced to pull over. Kevin Spacey's accuser also came to court today to give evidence from behind a curtain. Jurors were told it was so the witness could concentrate better on his evidence. Mr. Spacey denies 12 charges, including sexual assault and indecent assault. The trial continues.
Helena Wilkinson reporting. Now, what do you do if you have a lot of food for a state banquet and then your illustrious guest doesn't show up? That was a dilemma facing the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, this week when the French leader, Emmanuel Macron, called off his visit because of the riots in France. But Mr. Steinmeier had an idea. Oliver Berlau tells us what it was.
Emmanuel Macron was scheduled to land in Berlin for a three-day visit. A banquet was planned in his honour at the Bellevue Palace. Mr. Macron cancelled his trip because of the unrest at home, and the food was expected to be thrown out. But the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, didn't want to do that. One scheduled stop of Mr. Macron's visit would have been the Malt Factory, a cultural centre for young people in Berlin at the site of the old Malt House. So Mr. Steinmeier decided that he would throw a garden party there and offer the food meant for his French guest to the young artists, Germans, Frenchmen and Ukrainians. They could feast on tomatoes in lovage stock and Basil emulsion, crabs from Friesland with dumplings and Prince Pückler ice cream. There was also a choice of 18 wines from the Rhineland and Franconia. Not, as one German newspaper put it, the usual chips and doner kebab.
Oliver Berlau reporting. Next to tennis, the Wimbledon tournament in London has begun. The defending men's singles champion, Novak Djokovic, is seeking his 24th Grand Slam title and the chance to equal Roger Federer's men's record of 8 Wimbledon titles. The women's world number one, Iga Swiatek, is bidding for her first Wimbledon title. Sportsworld's Della Floyd was watching the matches at the All England Lawn Tennis Club. So, a pretty straightforward first round for Novak Djokovic.
Certainly was. I mean, the defending champion eased through against the world number 68, Pablo Cachin of Argentina, 6-3, 6-3, 7-6. I mean, play was halted a little bit earlier due to a rain delay, but that didn't seem to affect Djokovic at all. Remember, he comes into Wimbledon having won his 23rd Grand Slam title a few weeks ago in Paris. He says he's as motivated as ever. There may be a couple of players on his side of the draw that may cause him a few problems down the line, the likes of Yannick Sinner, I'm thinking of Hubert Hurkacz as well. And of course, Carlos Alcaraz, the new player on the block, the new superstar, gets his campaign underway tomorrow. Could await Djokovic in the final.
And quite an easy first day for the women's world number one as well.
It certainly was. Iga Swiatek, as you say, breezed through her opening round match 6-1, 6-3 against Xu Lin of China. The four-time Grand Slam champion has never, believe it or not, progressed beyond the fourth round here. But as I say, she's a major winner of four times and looked very, very good at ease today. So I'd back her to go quite deep, I think, in the draw.
And Venus Williams is back.
She's back, but she's looking as though she could be heading out, playing in her 24th Wimbledon Championships, a tremendous, tremendous achievement. And they've just called game, set and match for Elina Svitolina of Ukraine. I think Williams was debating challenging the call. She's accepted it. The crowd on centre court rise to applaud Williams, a five-time champion here at the All England Club. Turned 43 years of age a few weeks ago. One of the stories of the last two decades, really. She first played at Wimbledon in 1997, Jeanette. A crowd favourite, but she's been knocked out by Elina Svitolina of Ukraine in front of me now. So disappointing for her, but what a true performer.
Dennis Lloyd at Wimbledon. The last surviving Frenchman to take part in the D-Day landings during World War II has died. Léon Gauthier was 100 years old. He was part of an elite French commando unit that waded ashore into German-occupied northern France alongside US, British and other Allied forces. The D-Day landings on June the 6th, 1944, were the largest amphibious wartime operation ever. Thousands died on the first day alone, but the attack established a foothold in Normandy that helped to reverse the Nazis' domination of Western Europe, eventually resulting in their defeat. With a look back on the life of a French hero, here's Charles Haviland.
Léon Gauthier, born in Rennes in Brittany, enlisted in the French Navy as a teenager soon after the Second World War began, escaping to Britain months later. Becoming part of the Free France movement in London, he fought in Congo, Syria and Lebanon and joined the unit of marine riflemen known as the Kieffer Commandos. Trained in the Scottish Highlands, they became the only French fighters to participate in D-Day. He He would recall how a British commander let them disembark from their landing craft before everyone else, in a symbolic recognition that the French were reclaiming their homeland. During the 80-day Battle of Normandy that followed, Gautier's unit lost more than half its forces. He would later denounce war because, as he put it, you kill a man who's done nothing to you.
I think the first thing is to preserve peace. Do what it takes to keep the peace. Because war is a misery. It ends with widows and orphans. War is a misery.
Despite his terrible war memories, for his final decades, Léon Gautier made his home at Ouistreham on the Normandy coast, just a few hundred metres from the German bunker that had directed fire at the beach where he'd landed. On his death, the mayor called him a local hero and an ardent defender of freedom.
Charles Haviland. And that's all from us for now, but before we go, how do you feel about artificial intelligence? It seems to be here to stay, so what good do you hope it can be used for? Or do you foresee a world in which it will be used for bad? Please send us your thoughts on an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, Yaya Toure here for a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Join me and fellow footballers, Gabriel Zakwani.
Hello.
And Ifan Okuku.
Hi.
As we choose our top 10 from the best of Africa football.
We're not here to play football, but to argue about all things African football.
That's Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcast.